Welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In recent weeks, there has been interesting developments with two frack gas projects in the Northwest. In December, the Washington State Department of Ecology rejected the final supplemental environmental impact statement that Northwest Innovation Works submitted for their proposed methanol refinery in Kalama. Northwest Innovation Works refused to respond to the concerns that the Department of Ecology raised, and so the department determined that they will conduct the environmental impact statement themselves. Then a few weeks ago in Southern Oregon, the Department of State Lands denied Jordan Cove LNG's umpteenth request for an extension for the removal fill permit application, stating that the application was woefully inadequate. So Jordan Cove withdrew their application, knowing it was about to be denied. Today we talk with two people who've been giving a lot of thought to what this all means for the future of the Northwest. Dan Sears is the Conservation Director with Columbia Riverkeeper, and Damon Mott-Story is the Healthy Climate Program Director with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. Dan and Damon, welcome back to Luck is Focus.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's always great to have you guys on. Well, we're going to start, before we start talking amongst ourselves, with a bit of a clip that I recorded last Tuesday at a wonderful event at the Department of State Lands, where people gathered to thank the Department of State Lands and Director Vicki Walker for basically setting it up so that Jordan Cove would withdraw the permit application to the Department of State Lands. So I'm going to start by hearing from, I think it's five people that spoke, beginning with Jeff Golden, who I believe was the very first state elected official who came out against Jordan Cove?
Pam Marsh, his representative in his same district.
Okay, yeah. And he came out second. I saw it as I was going through photographs for the slideshow I just put together for my Jordan Cove documentary. I saw at the hearings in Jackson County that Jeff Golden was right there in the front row, intently looking. So it's nice to see him in the flesh. We're also going to hear from Anna Helms, who is a Coos Lower Umpqua Siuslaw Indian, Pam Ordway, who's a landowner in Douglas County who's impacted by the pipeline, another landowner impacted by the pipeline in Coos County, Mike Washburn, and Rowena Jackson, who read the 20th draft of her amazing poem, Water is Life. So we'll start with that, and then we'll start talking with Dan and Damon.
So we have a project here that proposes that a 36-inch volatile gas pipeline be laid underneath and over 500 waterways of the state. And you ask, on what planet could that not compromise the state waterways? How could a project possibly be designed to meet that criterion? And the answer is, it's impossible. And they may have known that from the beginning, and their strategy was to see if they could bulldoze the state process through political pressure, because they're not going to win on the merits, and knew that all along. And what Vicki Walker said very clearly in her denial of their extension request is, actually, no, you can't do that. We have a job to do here. The strategy now for this project is to wholly ignore Oregon and its requirements, and to have the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission approve it, and somehow have the courts rule that Oregon laws that quite clearly can't be preempted by the federal government can be. It is a tremendous long shot, but it is the only shot this project has for approval. The reason we're here today is largely because of the hard work for years of the people behind me and thousands other across the state, and our work is not over. We need to do everything we can to thank and support the state officials who are doing their job, to support the legal fight that almost certainly is coming to uphold the law of the land. So great work, everybody. Onward. Let's get this project buried once and for all.
This project has been around for 15 years. That's more than adequate time. Meanwhile, the process has greatly been unfair to the people who have lived and protected these waters and lands since time immemorial. Pembina has failed to have meaningful consultations with the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians, and they failed to consider all of the items around cultural and natural resources within the environmental impact statement. This lengthy process has also been incredibly costly, and my tribe would rather see millions of dollars poured into restoration projects. It's evident that Jordan Cove Energy Project is not here to do us any favors, but to profit from our resources while taking away from the local clam, oyster, and fish economy, while the largest emissions of greenhouse gases will have adverse effects on our climate. Our songs, stories, language, cultural teachings come from the water and the land, and perpetuate our unique identity. And it is through our knowledge, beliefs, and stewardship that we continue to stand to protect our cultural resources. Thank you.
As an impacted landowner, it has been really hard to wait and have faith that the process will work. But having the Division of State Lands deny Pembina's request for yet another extension gives me hope that the state will protect our rights. We all know that denial for an extension played no small part in them withdrawing their application. I am reassured that the state of Oregon values input from its citizens. Instead of just taking Pembina at its word that everything is going to be all right, our state agencies have taken the time and the care to look at the proposed project and make their own determination of whether or not it meets the standards Oregon has set to protect our people, our wildlife, and our lands. And for that, we applaud them.
After 15 years of holding all affected landowners hostage, Pembina's inability to get the application right makes me wonder how competent they will be in building the plant and the pipeline. This is a dangerous proposition. Finally, I hope the governor will protect Oregon's authority to stop Jordan Cove, even if the federal government decides to try to change the rules. The very last thing is, taking our property for the enrichment of a foreign business is outrageous. Thank you.
I am water from Klamath and Crater Lake. It is a given to protect and love our fish for all my relations and next generations. I will protect our stolen village sites. I embrace tribal sacred sites. Rest in peace, my ancestors. Heads up, oppressors and even investors. Vicky Walker and Department of State Lands as we gather on stolen homelands. Last year, I said, you too can be a water protector. Pembina's been denied their fifth deadline extension. And I ask, seal the deal, deny Pembina of a renewal application. Pembina is climate change to this nation. Deny Pembina with prejudice, which means forever. Stand up to FERC. Future permits adds to this crisis. Wyden's letter to the president. FERC's final decision making with an unbalanced board. FERC's process has been unfair. Please end this necessary nightmare. Last year I said, water is life, a clear conscience is a blessing. No regrets in the afterlife because you opposed and stopped the oppressing. Today, unity prevails, delaying corporations to dominate, saving our salmon and whales before it's too late. United we stand as we raise our hands.
And that was Rowena Jackson, who is a Klamath tribal member and, I guess, poet laureate of the Klamath Nation. So we are here with Dan Sears, who's with Columbia Riverkeeper, and Damon Mastori with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. First, I just wanted to just get a little bit of a sense of your response to what happened last Tuesday and where we go from here. So I'll start with Dan.
Sure. I think the first thing that really jumped out to me was the strength of the voices from Southern Oregon and the fact that after 15 years, there are people who are still building momentum and making new connections and making the argument in, you know, even more emphatic and influential ways, including Senator Jeff Golden. I think he said something very well when he said, you know, it's a tremendous long shot for this project to proceed at all at this point. And, you know, one thing I really want to emphasize for people listening to this is no matter what happens at this point, the state of Oregon has spoken. They have either denied or refused to issue the major permits for this huge Jordan Cove project and for the Pacific Connector pipeline. And that puts the people who are resisting this project in Southern Oregon in a much stronger position to be fighting alongside the state of Oregon to protect Oregon's interests. Is a much better place to be than to be, you know, kind of fighting a war on two fronts, dealing with maybe a bad decision from Oregon alongside a bad decision from FERC. And so what we expect to happen this week is FERC is very likely to issue an approval for the project, but that approval should be dead on arrival because the state of Oregon has refused to authorize this project. And so no matter what happens this week, I want people to know that the organizing has made a difference, your voices have made a difference, And standing in solidarity with the people in Southern Oregon who've been fighting this for 15 years has made a difference. We are going to stop this project. I am more convinced of that than I have ever been.
Well, you were telling me before we went on the air, Dan, that you think that Pembina is nervous. And I wonder what makes you think that? And what does that mean?
Yeah, there was an investor article that came out just this last week that Allie Rosenbluth from Southern Oregon caught, and she sent our way. And one of the things they floated was the potential for flipping the feeder pipeline for the Pacific Connector, the Ruby pipeline, to an oil pipeline. Now, this is the first I'd heard of this. People in Southern Oregon have been talking about this for some time, and it should come as no surprise that they knew this might come. But the idea of floating a totally alternate purpose for this fossil fuel, you know, super extreme fossil fuel project tells me they're not all that confident in the prospects for their LNG proposal. And I think that's a tacit admission that the LNG project is potentially falling apart.
If you look at the track record, the sort of history, if we zoom out here, again, this is a 229-mile proposed gas pipeline through four Southern Oregon counties that would then link up to a massive LNG export facility in Coos Bay to ship liquefied natural gas out to foreign markets, not for any domestic use. And so I think that they've realized over the course of the past couple of years, you know, they were denied by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in 2016. They reapplied when the Trump administration came into office. And then they have gotten zero of their Oregon State authorizations for this project, authorizations that they need in order to go through. In May of 2019, the Department of Environmental Quality denied the Clean Water Act Section 401 permit. And the Clean Water Act gives states the authority to review the environmental impacts of major projects like this and deny them if they're a threat to the water quality of the state.
Well, Trump has been making a lot of noises. In fact, I think he issued an executive order or something that would really roll back the rights that states have to protect clean water within their states. So how does that fit into the game plan that Pembina and Jordan Cove might have?
He's certainly trying to do that, but he hasn't done it yet. And that's a very important point to make, right? He's not been successful at rolling back these authorizations. And that's just one of three major authorizations that the state of Oregon has to sign off on for a project like this to go through. So there's the Department of Environmental Quality's Clean Water Act review, and then there's the Coastal Zone Management Act review process overseen by the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development. And then there's the Department of State Lands removal fill permit that has to do with, dredging and removing soil and water and things like that to be able to make room for the terminal and the pipeline. And that is the permit that was going to be decided on January 31st when Pembina withdrew their application in fear of a denial. And I think it really shows that they know they can't meet Oregon's standards in any of these three major arenas.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM. Today we're talking with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper and Damon Mott-Story with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility about the latest developments in the ongoing struggle to stop frack gas projects in the Northwest. Now, I'm thinking back, it wasn't that long ago that people were really upset with Kate Brown because there's something to do with tsunami zones and allowing infrastructure to be built in tsunami zones. And I'm a little fuzzy on it, so can one of you sort of clarify what I'm trying to talk about?
Yeah, there had been a proposed restriction, or actually there was a restriction on the books to say that certain types of critical infrastructure shouldn't be built in tsunami inundation zones, and that requirement was removed in part because of, you know, folks from the Coastal Caucus on the South Coast who had been pushing to have the ability to build not just critical infrastructure, but a lot of different things.
Now, this was not Kate Brown's decision. This was a legislative decision by our supermajority Democratic legislature.
That's right. And that means Kate Brown was a part of it. She could have vetoed it, but she didn't.
That's right. And so, I mean, that for good reason gave people concern and pause about where the state was headed with dealing with something like an LNG terminal in a tsunami inundation zone. And I think it's heartening to see now the state actually holding its ground and saying, no, for these natural resource reasons, the dredging through, you know, up to 500 streams and waterways across Southern Oregon, the trenching, I should say, for building a pipeline, that would be inconsistent with Oregon standards. But there's no question that there's still a real concern about, you know, tsunamis and natural hazards on the coast, and those issues remain very, very important for the people in Southern Oregon and on the whole Oregon coast.
Well, I keep having in my head the voices of all these people I interviewed in Southern Oregon who kept saying, starting about a year ago when I started doing the interviews, that their hope was Kate Brown and the legislature and the Department of State Lands and the Department of Environmental Quality. And when people, close to 100 people sat in Kate Brown's office back in November and 21 people got arrested, Kate Brown at that point was still not willing to make a strong stand. I've heard all kinds of interesting reasons, explanations for the strategy she's been taking, and some people even compare it to Nancy Pelosi's strategy with impeaching Trump. But I wonder what your take is. Do you think that Kate Brown has a strategy and that she actually really will stand for what's best for Oregon, or do you think she's still doing a lot of political maneuvering which might jeopardize the future of Oregon?
So that was then and this is now, right? So like what Kate Brown was saying during the amazing action that was happening in her office in November at the end of last year is that she wanted to not influence the state agency's process over this. And the development that has happened since then is the state agency was very scrupulously holding Jordan Cove LNG to account for all of the possible negative impacts to waterways. And Jordan Cove LNG knew that they couldn't meet those high standards and pulled out of their application. So now what we're seeing here is they're not trying to play by the rules. They're not trying to go through and get all of their authorizations. That's something that the company has been saying for a long time, is that they've been making these sort of egregious claims that they're going to do everything by the books and they're going to be good neighbors. And we all know that that's false. And we all know now that they're not planning on playing by the rules. And so this is, you know, sort of a new environment for Kate Brown, and it's time for her to stand with the Southern Oregonians who are resisting the federal government steamrolling over the state authorizations for a project like this.
Well, I've heard a lot of concern about litigation and what that would mean. Now, Jeff Golden, I cut out the part where he says that he's never known a lawyer that was good enough to be able to do what Jordan Cove is expecting, which is to have federal environmental decisions preempt state environmental laws. However, what rumblings have you heard about what their litigation strategy might be?
I think it's absurd, their legal strategy. I think that they've lost, you know, when it comes to trying to push this project. I don't know how else to say it other than it's going to have to be the people of Oregon helping the state and pressuring the state to remain vigilant and to fight for our authority. But just to lay it out, you know, they would have to first preempt the state's coastal zone decision, which cannot be an approval at this point because they haven't received the permits that are necessary for that. They would have to argue that the state has either waived its Clean Water Act authority or that there's some other authority that would supersede it, which doesn't yet exist. As Damon mentioned, those changes haven't actually been made to Clean Water Act. Then they have to somehow argue that they don't need the removal fill permits that they just withdrew. They weren't applying for these things for the fun of it. They applied for them initially because they need them, and they are a precursor to, for instance, the coastal zone permit. And then finally, what it comes down to is they have to somehow convince the judge that they have the right to use eminent domain on state land. So if the state of Oregon refuses to grant the use of its waterways and lands, this project can't proceed either. So it's not just the three permitting decisions, it's even the state's proprietary rights. This is a bleak, bleak picture for an LNG project and a pipeline. And the fact that there is this now brick wall of decisions and obstacles from the state of Oregon is a direct result of the type of action we saw in November and the pressure that has gone on for 15 years to hold the state to account and to let them know that if they do the right thing, when they do the right thing, the people of Oregon will stand behind them. And that is happening all over Oregon right now.
Now, you make a comment about the pressure that the demonstration and the sit-in had on decision-making back in November. I remember back in November that there was maybe a bit of disagreement among some of the Jordan Cove people, I mean, the people fighting Jordan Cove in Southern Oregon about whether that was a good strategy or not. And I'm wondering if, in hindsight, even the people who thought, well, we have to be continuing to stay, you know, within the law and not break the law, if they maybe realize or recognize that it was a good action. And in fact, the fact that nobody got had their charges pressed was an indication to me that the state was not too upset about that demonstration.
Yeah, I think one thing that's worth remembering is that, yeah, there were 100 or so people that sat in the governor's office for hours and hours and hours refusing to leave until she opposed the project. That was amazing. But what immediately preceded that also deserves a lot of our attention, which is that we saw nearly 1,000 people from across Oregon and from Northern California, people who would be impacted even in Northern California by this project, came and had an enormous rally, just a sea of red, on the steps of the Oregon State Capitol
building. And inside the rotunda.
And inside the rotunda, chanting, which, I mean, it was an incredible feeling hearing everybody chanting in unison that we've got the power. And that was an amazing mobilization, and I think the message still really carries to right now, right? Like, this state, we have the power to stop this project, and that's not going away. You can look at the history of how other massive fossil fuel proposals in Oregon and Washington have, you know, received a major permit denial, and then that process got put into the courts, but was upheld by different court decisions, right? Because these are just all of these fossil fuel projects are such a massive detriment to health and safety. So I think, you know, I'm looking at this trajectory. I wouldn't want to be working for Jordan Cove LNG right now, because that looks like a really thin prospect to get this thing through. And you know, I think it's also particularly relevant to remember that rally, you know, because the media is right now is having a circus over the, you know, handful of people that showed up in trucks at the state capitol to protest climate action. And you know, let's not forget the fact that one of the largest mobilizations we've seen in Salem recently was people across different political parties. So many different types of people from Southern Oregon and people in solidarity from other parts of the region coming out to say that we need a clean energy future,
and
not this project.
They weren't carrying guns.
No, that's right.
it's one of my strong beliefs is that nonviolence is the way to go. But I think that the power of 1,000 people without guns is way more powerful than the handful of people who are armed.
Yeah, and I think that shows you the unity that exists in opposition to this project. There's a lot of people that try to play up some of the differences and fragmentations, but the fact of the matter is the overwhelming majority of people across all different lines of differences don't want this project to be built.
Another thing that's really changed, even just in the year that I've been going down to Southern Oregon and getting much more engaged as opposed to interviewing Jody McCaffrey here while she's down in Coos Bay or North Bend, but I feel like there is a really major shift in awareness statewide and region-wide about what's happening, what could happen in Jordan Cove, and also understanding that this is an incredible movement, maybe the most powerful movement in all of the Northwest, are these people who would have been just not even known about by most of the activists in the rest of the region. So I wonder if that's something that, it's not just my perception, if you think that that's really happening, and what has given rise to that kind of statewide, region-wide awareness, and how that can be channeled to further action?
Well, I think for far too long, Southern Oregon has really been ignored by a lot of the rest of the state of Oregon, and for a lot of things that are really important. You know, not just the crises that are being experienced, right? Like, we are experiencing an affordable housing crisis here in Portland, but there also is a big affordable housing need in Southern Oregon. And we also need to be looking to them for the leadership that they've been showing, not just on this particular issue, but the City of Talent in Oregon passed a 100% renewable energy commitment before the City of Portland did. And, you know, that's really worth paying attention to, right? Like, it's really showing that there's a lot of leadership and a lot of important stuff to be working on in the rural parts of the states that often gets overlooked by those of us in the Portland metro area.
Just as an aside, this isn't about Southern Oregon, but it's south of us. City of Milwaukee, I understand, is the first Oregon city to declare a climate emergency. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. I believe so.
And that's where you live, Dan, right? It must be because you live there. But
I live just south. I live in Oak Grove, yeah. So unincorporated Clackamas County, so we have to work in the Clackamas County Commission next. But
which is better than it used to be. So it's,
yeah, I mean, and there's something else I want to just like put out there, which is people in rural Oregon have been fighting huge fossil fuel projects now for much longer than anyone else. You know, if you look at Clatsop County, Oregon, and Coos County, Oregon.
It was only 12 years for Clatsop County.
Right, and they wrapped it up real quick in 12 years. And the same is going on in Kalama, where people in Southwest Washington have been, you know, pretty heroically fighting these mega fossil fuel projects as well, whether that's an oil train terminal or a methanol refinery. And so this idea that that climate issues fall on this urban-rural divide, I think is a false one. I think it's really important to acknowledge that people in rural Oregon have been leading this and doing it very capably. And, you know, Jody McCaffrey has been fighting this for 15 years and knows more about LNG than I would venture to say anyone in the Western United States.
I would say this is one of the things that I connected with. I mean, I guess as an Oregonian, and I have to, I mean, I'm an adopted Oregonian. I've only lived here for 48 years. So, you know, it's
longer than I have.
Right. Longer than either you, twice as long as you did. But I've always lived in Northern Oregon, but I've always had an affinity for Southern Oregon and spent a lot of time there. And I discovered when I was down there for the first time doing this project that a piece of land that I hung out a lot on in the 70s and 80s has the pipeline going through it in Douglas County. And it just kind of brought it home. And it felt like, I feel like if all of us as Oregonians embrace the entire state, and it means that we got to start dealing with the east side too and really understanding the issues out there and maybe dealing with the Wolf Divide and stuff like that. But that there, this state is something that is, we're all part of this whole state. And so I look at what's going on in Southern Oregon, and I feel like they are really the leaders of maybe a very new movement that we can really kind of learn a lot from up here.
Oh, the reason why we're here and winning this campaign is because the organizing work that's being done in Southern Oregon is truly exemplary and is setting a model for, you know, movements worldwide, right? It's a really phenomenal thing that's happening. And, you know, I also mentioned, right, like, you know, it's important for us in Portland to be in solidarity with people in Southern Oregon fighting this, but it's also important for all Oregonians to be in solidarity with the egregious LNG projects that are happening all over the place, right? So the Canadian government is being particularly brutal against First Nations that are working to block an LNG project in British Columbia, as an example. So we all need to be really thinking about the Wet'suwet'en and the Unist'ot'en camp. So,
not to mention the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Right. I mean, there's also oil is a big deal. And then there's a little community of Kitimat up in northern, northwestern British Columbia, which is just, I mean, when I first learned about it, it was because it was going to be the outtake for the Northern Gateway Pipeline, which got killed. And I thought, oh, this is a beautiful little community. And I mean, it's further north than I've been, but you know, it's really just mild and remote. No, it's like the fossil fuel industry has their eyes on it as being like this big mega export center. So I think it's important, as you're saying, to like think of the whole West Coast. And also we've the Jordan Cove people have learned, or the opponents of Jordan Cove learned a lot from Californians who were fighting LNG back in the years before Jordan Cove got started. So I think this, like, having a West Coast alliance is a really important thing.
And this is how we are going to make progress on climate change, right? We need to be able to make a really bold message that doesn't just say, not in my backyard, but not anywhere, right? Like, these massive new fossil fuel infrastructure projects need to be dead on arrival, no matter where they are in the world, in order for us to get off of fossil fuels and mitigate the climate crisis.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM. And today we're talking with Damon Mott Story, who's with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper. We're talking about the latest developments in the ongoing struggle to stop frack gas projects in the Northwest. I want to touch a little bit about what's going on in Kalama, which we just kind of mentioned superficially. There was a nice celebration there. Actually, this was a little bit ironic. There was a celebration the first week in January, or second week in January, up in Kalama to celebrate some sort of good news that we'll talk about. At the same time, I was texting back and forth with Larry Magnin in Coos Bay to find out what was going on with the Coos Bay City Council meeting, where they that day approved the dredging of Coos Bay. That was not a Jordan Cove project, but actually was for the benefit of Jordan Cove, and Jordan Cove had bankrolled the whole application. So it was kind of a mixed day. But let's talk about the happy moments and just how happy should people in Kalama and in the rest of the Northwest be?
Well, for Kalama, what they accomplished is really, really remarkable. If you rewind the clock by, you know, about 14 months, you know, this was a project that had received a very skewed environmental impact statement drafted by the Port of Kalama and Cowlitz County, essentially drafted by Northwest Innovation Works itself, which is the company proposing what would be the world's largest methanol refinery. A refinery that would use 300 million cubic feet of gas a day. To give you some sense, it's about half of what the entire state of Oregon uses in terms of frack gas. And it would turn it into methanol and export it to China. So it's a pretty remarkable proposal that had been kind of slinking along in the background, kind of in the shadow of the huge oil train terminal that was proposed in Vancouver. And, you know, through organizing, through really effective advocacy, they persuaded the state of Washington that the environmental impact statement was so skewed and so inaccurate that the state of Washington refused to issue the shorelines permit and said, I'm sorry, but you have misstated the facts of this project, and we have to do our own analysis because the analysis that's in front of us is not legally sufficient to even make a decision. That happened actually on the day after we were all in Salem at the Jordan Cove project rally. So a pretty remarkable couple days there. And it's just a huge credit to the people in Kalama who for three or four years with almost no one listening to them were pointing out, look, the methane that goes into this project escapes into the atmosphere at a much higher rate than they're admitting. The methanol will not be used to offset coal-based methanol. In fact, it will be burned, and if anything, it will be competing with cleaner forms of energy.
It'll be burned, but as
fuel. Fuel, right? Yeah, the company was trying to claim that the methanol would only be used to clean up the plastics manufacturing process, which is what was absurd on its face. And then in the middle of all this, someone who was a potential investor in the project happened to forward us information that directly corroborated what people in Kalama had been saying for years, that the company was lying, that the company was misstating what the purpose and impact of the methanol refinery would be, and they won the argument with Department of Ecology, who is now in 2020 going to undertake their own environmental impact statement. I mean, this isn't victory. The project hasn't yet collapsed and pulled the plug, but they were... The methanol developer was extremely angry that they didn't get the permit that they had been banking on. And, you know, in 2020, we'll have an opportunity to make our case once again with the state of Washington to try to persuade them not only that the previous analysis was insufficient, but that any fair analysis would show that this project is a climate disaster. And it's not just a climate disaster. You know, there's a really compelling argument. Mike Reuter is the mayor of Kalama, has been telling anyone who will listen to him, and that audience is growing, that it's also an economic threat to Cowlitz County because of the enormous amount of gas that a single customer would be using, and that could potentially impact energy prices and other gas users in the region. And if you think about, you know, a mill or something in Cowlitz County, they use a lot of gas. So it's a pretty interesting argument that is, I think, novel, and I think something that the state of Washington and even the state of Oregon should be investigating to see. Not only is this project a threat to the climate, but they will probably need another huge pipeline in order to push it forward. In fact, we're convinced they're going to need another huge pipeline to push it forward.
That sounds a little bit like the days when Jordan Cove was saying that they were going to use the existing 12-inch pipeline.
That's right. It's just a few of us who remember that. At the very beginning, right. they were sort of mumbling to people that, oh yeah, there's already a gas line into Coos Bay. And Jody McCaffrey did the math and figured out you couldn't fit a billion cubic feet in a 12-inch line. And it's pretty simple. Well, it turns out that you can't get 300 million cubic feet out of a fully subscribed Williams pipeline. Mm-hmm. And so that is the dynamic in Kalama right now, which means that we are going to have to connect that work in Kalama, and we are already with the people who are fighting new fossil fuel infrastructure in King County, Washington, where a pipeline could come down the I-5. People who are like Bark, who are watchdogging and making sure the Palomar pipeline over Mount Hood doesn't come back, because that could be a feeder pipeline for Kalama. And people who may not even know that they could be facing a pipeline proposal in the Columbia River Gorge at some point in the future. So we will be watching for these things even as we're trying to kill and really put to sleep this monstrous Kalama methanol refinery.
Well, one of the things that made me hopeful when the Department of Ecology took back charge of writing the final supplemental environmental impact statement is that they were so critical of both the supplementary environmental impact statement that was proposed for Kalama methanol as well as the one for Tacoma LNG for the same reasons, because of all the fallacies with greenhouse gas emissions and some other things as well, and concerns about in Kalama that being used as fuel. Does that give you a sort of a foreshadowing of what you think the approach that the Department of Ecology will take in writing the environmental impact statement?
I can only hope that they will be more factually accurate than the company that wrote the EIS for Northwest Innovation Works.
They're not going to be hiring...
No, they're in the process of deciding who they're hiring right now.
Okay, so it won't be Ecology and whatever. I forget the company. And then it was Life Cycle Associates.
That's right.
Down in outside of Stanford, who wrote the EISs, wrote the life cycle analyses for both Kalama and for Tacoma. So I'm assuming they're not going to use that guy again.
I assume they will not.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think, you know, it's also an opportunity to make the case, you know, and you mentioned Tacoma LNG, which has enormous potential health and safety impacts for people who live nearby, and something that PSR has been really highlighting in their outreach as well. And these two projects are quite linked in that they are really very large fracked gas projects that impose really significant health and safety risks. So it's not even just the climate risk. It's like if you're just sitting in one of these communities and you're worried about what the future of your community looks like, these projects pose a major threat.
Yeah, and I think really one of the things worth celebrating here is what we are seeing in similar strokes at the state of Oregon and the state of Washington is our state agencies are doing their job. These sorts of review processes are meant to be to make sure that the long-term climate impacts of these sorts of projects are considered, right? That's what we need all of our state agencies to be doing if they're not already doing it. And also the short-term immediate risks to public health and safety are being considered before getting a rubber stamp of approval, right? And in an era when Environmental Protection Agency standards and so many other federal standards are being just completely steamrolled over and rolled back, it's incredibly encouraging to see that both the state of Oregon and the state of Washington are holding these big fossil fuel projects to account and being really scrupulous about how the impacts are being measured. And so that's something I'm really excited to see. And you know, it really is credit to the people of Kalama who have, you know, sounded the alarm on this. You know, I don't know that this would have happened otherwise, right? You know, this is unfortunately something that we have to do is watchdog these kinds of things. I'm hoping that we get to a point where we're looking at major clean energy project investments, right, that are helping to put us on track for something that is not a massive risk to health and safety. So that we don't have to keep blocking and tackling on all of these for so much longer.
I'm going back in time to the very first fossil fuel hearing that I went to, which was several years ago, and it was around the it was for the coal terminal that was going to be built around Boardman, somewhere in that area, and the EQ was having a hearing in Portland. And you were very limited as to your comments. You couldn't talk about climate change. You couldn't talk about, you actually couldn't even talk about a lot of pollution. It was just had to do with how much pollution was going to come from the very coal dust that came off the trains, which people had good evidence about. But I was thinking how frustrating that hearing was, and how DEQ was like just so rigid in the way that they were seeing it. Have things changed? I mean, when DEQ or any of these other agencies are going to be considering these projects, are they not sticking strictly to the five qualifications that they have to consider, or are they looking at the bigger picture now?
I think it's changed a little bit, but there's a lot of more room for growth that needs to happen in terms of how state governments are looking at projects for their impact on the climate. Right at this point, it's like kind of a patchwork quilt. Right, there's a lot of different kind of, you know, standards of practice, and you know, I would make the case that in Oregon we have a lot of legislators and a lot of agency heads that really understand how much of an existential threat climate change is, but we still don't have, you know, a super powerful mandate in a lot of cases to be able to point to there being needing to be a extensive climate review in the process of a lot of different proposals, right? And so we still need more. We've made some progress. I think things are a little better now, but there's a long way that still that needs to come.
You know, and one of the things that's kind of interesting too is, you know, the state of Washington has a state environmental policy act. So they do environmental impact statements at the state level. That's a very powerful tool that allows them, as they learn more about things like, you know, fracking causes methane to leak all over the place, and methane is an incredibly potent greenhouse gas pollutant. And that dynamic is something they can bring into their analysis of a project like a huge methanol refinery in Kalama. The state of Oregon doesn't have that tool. And so what's interesting about Jordan Cove is because of the sheer magnitude of the physical impact they need to do to the environment, the state of Oregon has all the authority and all the review power it needs to say that this project conflicts not just with Oregon's climate goals, but very significantly with Oregon's clean water, public safety, natural resource protections. and, you know, for state waters and for state lands. And that's a, you know, something to her credit, Director Walker saw clearly in not being willing to buckle in under the pressure the Jordan Cove was trying to put.
Well, you were talking about a bit earlier about the concern about the Jordan Cove getting eminent or going for eminent domain on federal, on state lands. I understand there's a hearing tomorrow in Salem about a bill that might affect that. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Super interesting and compelling bill. House Bill 4105. There's some information up on our website about it at ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org, and I think on PowerPassFratGas.org as well.
I'll put a link onto it on this website too.
Thank you. Yeah. What the bill would do is two things. One, it would prohibit the establishment of any new major fossil fuel infrastructure, any new fossil fuel projects on state-owned land. So it cuts right to the issue, which is, should we be devoting our public lands and waters to establishing a whole new generation of fossil fuel lock-in? And credit to the people who sponsored this bill, including Senator Golden and Representative Karen Power, for being bold and for putting an idea out there that actually could have a real impact in helping to not just battle back these proposals as they come at us, but give the state some real authority in saying, no, we have a different clean energy future that we're trying to move towards. And that's also a future that protects the water quality, the drinking water. People in Oregon, PSR has done great research looking at the drinking water impacts of these potential pipelines. The bill has a second aspect, which would also implement the vapor pressure standard that Washington has for oil trains. So it tries to get at beefing up Oregon's standards for the trains, for instance, that are coming into the Zenith oil train terminal in Portland. And on both of these fronts, we think it's a significant step forward. And we're going to be encouraging the committee that's hearing it tomorrow to support the bill. The committee hearing is at 1 p.m. in hearing room D at the state capitol. If you happen to be listening and would like to come, that's going to be a great opportunity to weigh in.
Are there going to be carpools or anything to go down there? Anybody organizing that?
I don't know.
But if you can't make it and you'd like to still voice your support, it's really easy. You can do it in 60 seconds. You can send an email to hee.exhibits@oregonlegislature.gov. And you can just send a quick email. Make sure you mention the bill number, HB 4105. And you can submit testimony into the record in support of passing this bill to protect health and safety from fossil fuel infrastructure. So again, that's hee.exhibits@oregonlegislature.gov.
Well, since we live in the age of the internet, if you guys can send me that link and a little bit of information, I'll put it on both the Locus Focus page and even on my Facebook page, and we'll get the word out in the next day. So. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM. Today, we're talking with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper and Damon Mott-Story with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility about the latest developments in the ongoing struggle to stop frack gas projects in the Northwest. Well, I want to turn to more of a geopolitical viewpoint now. Let's pull out. There's been a number of conversations, both ones I've had with you guys and also ones I've been hearing buzzing around about global markets and for methanol and for LNG and how they may be impacted by things ranging from a possible war in Iran to the current novel coronavirus epidemic in China. So let's, I'm not sure, well, they actually, Dan, why don't you talk about this article that you were reading that talked about some concerns about a force majeure in terms of Chinese LNG contracts?
Yeah, so some state-affiliated Chinese LNG import companies have actually declared force majeure, which is essentially saying that an act of God that has forced them to cancel LNG purchases. It's a very unusual thing. Usually only happens if there's an equipment disruption, something like, you know, an equipment failure type of thing. So it's a pretty...
Or a big major, I mean, if there was a major earthquake or something like that, a tsunami.
Exactly. And so alongside the terrible human suffering that is going on right now in China, which I just want to acknowledge that is the most important dynamic that is going on here, that people are really suffering and struggling to protect their families and care for people.
And also totally cut off.
Yeah.
I mean, from each other, and people are like being basically imprisoned in their own apartments because there's such concern about quarantining.
Yeah. it is having an impact on energy markets. And so at this moment when Jordan Cove is teetering and trying to decide whether they really have a path forward, and you know, from our view, they don't, at least in the permitting realm, they also are facing a market that is increasingly hostile, where there is a glut of LNG on the global market. It's going to be increasingly difficult for something like a new build, very expensive LNG export facility in Oregon to compete on that market. And so I think it's a real dynamic that there are not just headwinds in terms of local resistance and state agencies now not giving permits, but also just in the bigger market. And that goes for methanol too. Now, it's methanol picture is slightly more complicated in that China is both a producer and a consumer of methanol. So it affects both sides of the equation. But still, this disruption in the economy really is having an impact on the potential investment that would go into these projects.
Also, we were talking a little while ago about the impact. This is actually back in January. We were talking the impact that at that time we thought we were going to go to war with Iran. Things change so quickly from week to week. So nobody's talking about Iran anymore, but I would imagine that's still a concern that there's
still a concern.
Yeah, and we'll get your PSR anti-war, anti-weapons of mass destruction perspective on this now, Damon. But how would a war with Iran impact the methanol market?
So we've seen that across the board, anytime the U.S. decides that they need to go to war and expand military conflict. And remember, we've been in a sequence of wars and conflicts in the Middle East and perpetuating and exacerbating conflict in the Middle East for about as long as I've been alive.
Longer.
Yeah, I would say so. Yep. You know, many millennials cannot remember a time when the U.S. was not actively at war, right? And so anytime that the U.S. justifies increasing military involvement, we see that that is connected very closely with how, you know, sort of an artificial demand for fossil fuels really is created by that, right? So, you know, there's a lot, oftentimes a bipartisan support in Congress to put enormous investments into the military, and that often feeds into an enormous consumption of fossil fuels of all varieties. How does this relate to methanol and the Kalama refinery? Well, one of the things that they were saying that the state of Washington really busted them on is that they were planning on using this as a marine fuel, right? And so that's something that could be used and sort of a false demand for that kind of a product could be increased if there's any kind of escalation of global military conflict by the United States.
Now, the other thing that I wonder, because I learned from Diane Dick in Longview that the world's largest methanol refinery currently is in Iran.
That's correct.
So is there other things going on in terms of competing with Iran or competing with Russia or whatever to become the primo methanol market supplier in the world?
It's a concern, you know, where I think you could imagine yeah, I mean, you can definitely imagine there being an interest from certain parts of the fossil fuel industry to get more of a market share. And I think the idea of going to war with Iran and disrupting that methanol production, I don't know if that's really a reason that's pushing it. I'm just not really the person
One of the ongoing issues in Iran particularly is we've been ratcheting up sanctions for ages, right? And the Trump administration has absolutely laid waste to the incredible peace and diplomacy efforts that were carried out before his administration to establish the Iran nuclear deal, which was an amazing, amazing agreement. Every time we see, you know, these sorts of sanctions being imposed, of course, it's the people of Iran who suffer the most from those sorts of things. And often it benefits U.S. corporations who have different products that would be, you know, sort of when you begin to limit the economy and the trade of a country, then you again are creating sort of an artificial inflation to the corporations in the United States. And it's worth also connecting this also to U.S. oil and gas extraction, right? Like Jordan Cove LNG was originally slated to be an import project, and it flipped to being an export project when the fracking boom in the Rocky Mountains and other parts of the North American shale gas reserves were being, you know, aggressively extracted. And these are not coincidences, right? You know, like the sort of attempt to make other markets less competitive. We've seen a lot of connections between, you know, very wealthy corporate interests working in tandem with the U.S. government to advance their agendas of being able to make their market goods and their export goods more competitive.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting. It gets really gnarly if you look at the Chinese connection with Kalama, because basically Northwest Innovation Works is a Chinese subsidity.
It's a Chinese government-owned
corporation. Yeah, right.
So
it seems to me that their primary allegiance is to the Chinese government, which seems like it might be a contradiction to having alliances with North American fossil fuel industries. So how does that all play out?
There's a deep interest in North American fossil fuel companies to try to, you know, force this gas out in any direction that will take it. So there are gas producers in Alberta and in Canada for both Jordan Cove and methanol.
And Pembina is an Alberta company.
Exactly. This is something that I think the projects have in common, is they are suffering for a lack of a market for that fossil fuel. And to the extent that we can interrupt these projects and the flow of this highly polluting, highly destructive fossil fuel energy from North America to other markets, we are having an impact and reducing the burden that future generations will face with a destabilized climate. So this is, it's a real dynamic where I think it's not just, for instance, the Chinese government trying to draw gas, but it's also the producers of this material trying to push it out. And so it's really both things working in tandem.
The fracking boom has been like a Pandora's box, right? Like, it's been so huge, this new glut of oil and gas that has been so aggressively pursued by different oil and gas industries in the United States, that they're looking for any possible way to market this stuff and get it out to consumers. And, you know, one thing I'll also just mention really quickly is, you know, it is just the Chinese government that's backing Kalama Methanol, right? And I remember visiting Beijing and Shanghai with the Portland Gay Men's Chorus in 2018, an incredible trip, right? And one of the things that was very striking to me was, you know, becoming friends with Chinese millennials in those choruses, right? And they're hearing their concerns about the way that air pollution is being exacerbated by oil and gas and other things in the country of China, right? And their sort of a lack of a voice in being able to influence their government on moving towards climate-safe practices, right? So I think it's really worth remembering that we can have solidarity with the people of China and while still resisting something the Chinese government is trying to build in Washington.
Well, I remember back a year plus ago during the hearings for the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement for Kalama, that one of the county commissioners stood up and basically was accusing the opponents of the methanol refinery being racist because they didn't want the Chinese people to have the same good air quality that Washingtonians had. And somebody later on from Tacoma stood up and basically contradicted that assertion by talking about all the huge protests that have been going on in the city, the main city in China where the methanol refineries are, or not the refineries, but the plastic facilities that make methanol into plastic. And that's something that most Americans don't know about. And actually, I don't know how many Chinese know about it, but it seems like there is, and we're seeing it now, we're seeing it around the coronavirus. People are starting to resist in China. And from the little that I've been able to glean in the last couple of years about all these protests that don't get reported in China, it seems to me that right beneath that really authoritarian surface, there's a lot of frustration and anger boiling up. And I'm wondering what your sense about that is.
No, I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. It's important to remember that the state of journalism in China is very different from the United States, but that does not mean that there isn't resistance and there isn't organizing. It's just a dangerous place to speak out and push back against the government. And so the calculus there, the whole situation is different, but that doesn't mean that people don't care about this, and it doesn't mean that people don't care about pollution in the United States on the ground level in China.
So in the last few moments that we have, what's the road ahead? What are you seeing are the next issues that people, or next steps people should be concerned about taking, and how do we see if we can get rid of Jordan Cove by the end of 2020?
Well, I think one of the most important things is for people to get engaged and stay engaged, right? Find your local climate advocacy group and get involved. Emma Maris, who was one of the people who was arrested in the state capitol.
She'll be on the show in a couple weeks.
Oh, wonderful. That's great.
Again.
You know, she mentioned on your show an op-ed that she wrote for the New York Times about five ways to stop freaking out about the climate crisis and get involved. And I think that's really important, right? Like, this actually can be very fun and very energizing work. You know, when you team up with communities, you start to then move away from despair to hope and get really inspired by all of the ways in which we can make a difference on a local level. So that's my biggest encouragement to listeners is read Emma Maris's op-ed in the New York Times, get involved with a local group, stay
engaged.
Tune
in 2 weeks when she's going to be on again, and we're going to go into a lot more detail about that. Mm-hmm. And Dan?
Yeah, when the time comes to organize around yet another hearing in Kalama, I think that folks in Southwest Washington always appreciate having everyone in KABU's listenership there to support them and to push back on that
project. We should have a KABU bus that goes up. Yeah. It'll probably be in Longview.
And even in the more short term, in the next 24 hours, if you have time and you have the opportunity to send a note to the House Energy and Environment Committee in support of House Bill 4105, we really encourage you to do that and to stay tuned to this show because this is a great place to learn a lot. And so thank you for having us.
Yes, well, thank you.
Thank you for all the work that you're doing and really appreciate having you on. Been talking today with Dan Sears, who's with Columbia Riverkeeper, and Damon Montstori with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KABU Community Radio in Portland and Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any other KABU Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll talk with Jan Zuckerman, Margaret Butler, and Michael Horner, who will be going to trial in a couple weeks for sitting on the railroad tracks by Zenith Energy last year. And their trial is going to be on February 24th, so we'll talk more about that next week. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Cassandra Wilson. Thanks for listening.
You may be rich, you may be poor, you may be young, you may be old, but when the law gets ready, you gotta move.